Who's the only one here who knows the illegal ninja moves from the government?
Chris.
Who throws a shoe? Honestly.
Ben.
Who would steal 30 bag lunches?
Danny.
Oh, you guys like to tell jokes and giggle and kid around, huh? Giggling like a bunch of young boys in the schoolyard.
Shoddy Radio.
We have a guest tonight, Zachary Moore, preferably Dr. Zach, I believe is what you like.
Well, so Dr. Zach is it kind of came about when I finally did get my PhD. I decided to get my own web domain, and Dr. Zach was the shortest, catchiest one that I could find, and so I just sort of took that on. And so you can just call me Zach; it's fine.
Okay, all right, Zach. Do you mind giving your credentials on the show? Just because you're by far the most credentialed and smartest guest we've ever had on our show, so it's almost like a bragging right for us that we have someone who's graduated even high school, let alone college, a couple times.
Well, gee whiz, guys. I mean it's not really that fancy. I went to college at the University of Cincinnati. I got a bachelor's degree in biology. I went right from there into a graduate program at the College of Medicine there, also at Cincinnati, where I studied in their pathobiology and molecular medicine program. It was a combined program between the pathology and laboratory medicine and also the internal medicine departments. And so I got a little taste of lab work. I got a little taste of lab work with an MD and a little bit of translational medicine in that respect. Basically, what that all means is basically all molecular biology type stuff. So studying the nature of the molecules that are inside us that make things move, and when they go bad, you know, what the diseases that you know transpire when certain things go haywire or when certain conditions take place.
Basically, we have the same resume. Yeah,
Chris is, you've almost nailed it. You guys basically were going down the same path at the same time.
I graduated from Oroville High with a gentleman C average.
I never made it to graduation, but I attended every day.
Well, that's kind of why I wanted to find an evolution podcast, because I was actually looking online, because I work all day at a job that doesn't require my brain, so I listen to podcasts all day long, and I'm a little bit embarrassed, like Danny is also, that we have such lack of science education, partly because we were taught in high school by two Mormon biology and physical science teachers.
Well, you know, that is a problem. And I even, in looking back on my own high school biology program, I mean, there was lip service at best that was paid towards evolution.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's okay. This is exactly why I wanted to have you on our show, because I started with a show called Radiolab, which I think does a very good job of making science interesting. I don't know. Have you ever listened to that show, Zach?
It is one of my favorites. There's just nothing else like it.
Absolutely. Anyone who is listening to our podcast, turn it off, go listen to a couple Radiolabs, and if you ever come back, thank you. But seriously, that is by far the best podcast out there. And that's why I wanted to have you on the show, is because Chris actually turned me on to your podcast, and I've since listened to every episode and I really enjoy it. But I realized I don't know anything about evolution. And
the problem with evolution, and I was really exposed to, getting a PhD, you know, I did have to take some evolution and ecology courses in college, but it was never really, taught to the rigor that is sort of required by the cultural controversy. And that's what really makes it interesting. There really is no other subject like mineralogy, right?
Uh-huh.
You didn't have the idea to bring on some expert in mineralogy just because you thought it was cool. I mean, you might at some point, but evolution has this sort of immediacy, this relevance, you know, to our culture right now, because there's this sort of back and forth, and there are sort of religious elements that are promoting, you know, either creationism or intelligent design, which is basically the same thing. And then you've got a sort of upswell, upsurge of academic and sort of peri-academic people who are trying to champion the cause of evolutionary theory, which is, you know, is all very, you know, well and good, and it's exciting, and it makes for a great sort of, you know, pub side conversation and all that stuff. But it also, I mean, it can be distracting from the fact that evolution is just a, it's just one of many topics within the field of biology. Now, it's a very important topic, and, you know, it really sort of, Dobzhansky says that, you know, that nothing else in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution, and it does really tie everything together. It's sort of like, you know, the rug and the Big Lebowski. Oh, man, it really ties the room together. Well, evolution kind of ties everything in biology together. Everything really makes sense if you look at it as a system which has evolved, something that has changed over time and continually been tweaking, you know, through the processes of natural selection.
Yeah, we all know what Dobzhansky says. I mean, you don't need to bring that up.
It was just some really famous biologist who thought a great deal of evolution.
No,
you have his poster hanging up in your room.
Yeah, I've got a signed autograph too.
Nice. That's got a. Is that in Beckett? No. Can you check the? No, I do. I find it very interesting. And you're right. It is something I wouldn't think of having a mineralogist on the show because that would be boring. But I find evolution very interesting. I guess one of the questions that I think most commonly gets brought up. Okay. Oh, that's one of what I wanted to say. One thing was on your podcast. One thing that I loved that you said was when talking about evolutionary theory was. That's one of the problems is that it's called evolutionary theory. It's not really a problem. It's just because most people don't understand that theory right. doesn't mean that it's not based on fact.
Well, so there's two. So the word theory has a more colloquial connotation, right? When most people say, oh, I've got a theory about that. Really what they're saying is, oh, I've got a pretty good idea. I've got a pretty good guess about how this or that happened. In science, theory takes on sort of a different dimension. You really apply theory to it's more than just an educated guess. It's more than just, you know, oh wow, I've got a hunch.
Right.
I'll throw my suggestion out in the ring. A theory is it really takes into account a huge amount of evidence and observations and conclusions and all sorts of different experimental results that have been compiled. Most likely over years and years and years, and you take all this stuff, and it's kind of like trying to put a puzzle together almost. And you take all this stuff and you put it together and says, what is the most reasonable picture that I can draw from this? You know, if you take all of this stuff together and you try to make sense in sort of like a you step back and you look at it from a top-down perspective and you say, what does this all really mean? And you come up with some sort of a grand explanation for everything that you're seeing, that grand explanation is the theory.
So a theory doesn't, you know, I think you said it pretty well. A theory doesn't mean it's just like an idea. I mean, evolution is accepted as fact for the most part by, I don't know, even the Catholic Church at this point, I think, accepts evolution as fact, right?
Well, officially, yes, they do. There are many Catholics that don't, of course.
Right.
There are some Catholics that don't accept heliocentrism, for example.
You're going to have to explain what heliocentrism,
the theory that the Earth revolves around the sun.
Yeah, you don't have to. I mean, I know what that is.
Right. Okay.
For your listeners.
Right, for the listeners.
I thought that was what you
actually. There actually is an Indiana next month. If this airs in October, this will be in next month. I think it's in November 2010 in Indiana, America. Uh-huh. There's actually a conference hosted by a number of Catholics that are arguing against the idea that the Earth revolves around the sun. This is for real.
Do any of them have their PhDs?
Yes, there are several people with doctorates that are part of that conference, believe it or not.
That is crazy.
That brings up one question I wanted to ask you about the whole Earth revolving around the sun or vice versa. I've wondered, and I've heard other people make this ask this question also. Historically, there's been lots of repression against science, morally and religiously. And I know there was a time when even studying cadavers was really not allowed. And I just wonder if you have any theories about how far along we could be.
And he means theories the way that we
I mean, like general ideas.
He
I don't
mean you need to have a grand scientific understanding of it.
Yeah. I mean, do you think we'd be much farther off than we are now if it weren't for this two steps forward, one step back?
It's tough to say. You're probably thinking of
the Paul Abdul song.
There's a graph that's made it around the internet where it shows, you know, improving human society or the level of technology, and then it hits the dark ages and it plummets to zero, and then it, you know, it finally comes back up, and it says, you know, if it had continued along this curve, we'd have flying cars by now. So
right,
thanks to all the Christians that caused the dark ages.
So we will have flying cars soon. Is that what you're saying?
Nice, Danny.
I'm sorry. Hello? Did he hang up on us based on that joke?
He didn't like that.
And if he did, I don't blame
him. Look, cars evolve. Deal with it.
Oh, I think it lost him. Wow. Don't interrupt Dr. Zach, I guess.
Prima donna.
All right, hang on. I think I disconnected him. Let me, I'm going to hang up on you, Ben, and call him right back.
I take two steps forward, I'll take two steps back. We come together because opposites attract, and you know it ain't fiction, just a natural fact. We come together because opposites attract. Two steps forward, two steps back.
So, Dr. Zach, you were talking about flying cars, I believe.
Right. So, yeah, so you're probably thinking of the graph that shows human progress over the years, and then there's a big dip once you hit the dark ages, and you know, it sort of anticipates or extrapolates the progress that could have continued on if the dark ages hadn't happened. And you know, basically the punchline is, you know, we could have had flying cars by now if it wasn't for the stupid Christians with their dark ages.
Exactly.
Well, do you believe that?
Well, you know, There is some truth to that. I mean, I think it's reasonably well accepted by historians, and especially historians of science, that there was not necessarily an anti-science, a sort of a sense of anti-science in the culture at that time, but there was definitely the sense that it didn't matter.
Okay.
And it was a situation where science suffered because emphasis was being placed on religious matters.
Yeah,
but it wasn't necessarily the case that you had these, you know, religious authorities that were seeking out scientific work and
well,
and
I think
wash it.
There are examples of that, though, aren't there as well? I mean, it wasn't Galileo even like forced to.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's true. I mean, it I'm not trying to defend.
Oh, I know. I understand. It's easy for all four of us to sit here as atheists and pile onto religion, and I don't want it to come across sounding like that either.
And in fact, you know, I don't know if I can actually make any sort of quantitative claim there, but I would say a great number of people that we would regard as the arch scientists of you know, the post-Renaissance world were themselves religious.
Sure.
And were motivated by the idea that, you know, if this was a world, if this was a cosmos that was constructed by an intelligent deity, then it had to follow some, you know, certain
right.
rules. And they were interested in finding out what those rules were. And they thought that they were describing the work of God, and through that process might learn more about God.
Sure.
And that's, in fact, I mean, that leads us right back to evolution, because that was the motivation for Darwin. He was, at the time it was called natural theology, and he was quite taken by the theories of William Paley, who you know, formalized the design argument for the Victorian era, and that's, you know, that's really what he thought he was doing. He started off in school with the intent of becoming a preacher of sorts, a religious professional.
I don't remember that.
Mm-hmm. And he was so interested in natural theology, which, you know, at the time it was called natural theology. It was really science.
Right.
They called it science at the time. They called it natural theology, and that's what got him on the Beagle. You know, primarily because it was an opportunity to indulge his interests, and his discoveries, on his voyage, prompted his continued investigation.
Sure.
Into what would eventually become his theory of evolution.
So, while we're on evolution, could you give your best, I guess, your most broken down summation of evolution?
So, all right. So, basically, it's best to think in terms of analogy, and in fact, Darwin did this. Think about dogs, right? There are all sorts of different varieties of dogs, and they all have different appearances. They have different colorations. They have, some of them have big heads, some of them have small heads, some of them have long snouts, some of them have short snouts. Well, it's a pretty well accepted and recognized fact that all these dogs, all the different forms of dogs, all the different breeds of dogs that we have today, all these dogs came from some sort of a common ancestor in the past, mm-hmm. right? So why do we think that? Well, for one, all the different species of dogs that we have right now, or all the different breeds of dogs, are all actually the same species. They all can interbreed,
right?
So you have a continuous breeding population. The only way that you can get a dog is to have another dog, a previous generation, that's, given birth to that, given rise to that. And so just sort of picture in your mind, well, you've got all these different types of breeds of dogs, and they take on all these different appearances, all these different body shapes, what you call morphologies. Mm-hmm. But we also know that they go back to some common ancestor. So if you can picture that in your mind, if you can picture the spreading out, as it were, of all these different dog breeds and the change over time that's happened to all these different dog breeds, that in itself is a microcosm, an analogy of really what's happened to all of biological life throughout history. So just as we have all living dogs today are all related, so in exactly the same way all humans are related to each other, because sure. We all have a common ancestor.
We actually have a couple questions for you, Dr. Zach, that some of our listeners sent in. I told them we were going to have a scientist on. This one says, do you think that the amount of hormones and chemicals we inject into our food is causing humans to mutate at a faster rate, speeding up human evolution, i.e. girls with huge boobs that start their periods in grade school from estrogen-injected chicken? Will female babies eventually be born with boobs?
If so, I'm for it.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that possible? Because I...
no, actually, I don't want to say that it's impossible. There are certain chemicals that are known carcinogens that if you're exposed to them, such as... they used to use them as insulators for electronic equipment. They're called PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, and other things that are known carcinogens. So there are substances out there that can cause cancer, through mutations of DNA. It's unlikely that simply increasing the amount of sort of stuff that's out there in the environment is going to drive our mutation rate in one direction or the other in terms of an effect on evolution. This is sort of, Futurama thinking, you throw people in a pool of toxic waste and they, grow a arm out of their head or something.
Hope you're not talking bad about Futurama, because this interview will be ended quickly.
That's a great show.
I'm just joking.
By no means. It's a very entertaining show, and there is some very good science in that. But But very often the writers give more leeway to something that's entertaining than something that's scientifically relevant.
So short answer, no boobs on babies.
Short answer, no. Well, I mean, in terms of affecting our, you know, boob growth and things like that, that actually has a lot more to do with just fat in the diet. So one of the things that is a recognized phenomenon is that, at least for women, the amount of body fat that they have is very important to the age in which they go through their first menses, the age in which they begin to develop, you know, all that has to do with you know, the amount of fat that they're actually taking in their diet. There are some tribes in Africa where the available fat in the available dietary fat is very minimal. Mm-hmm. And it, for those women in those tribes, it's so drastic. I mean, it, you know, they're able to survive, but it's so drastic on their reproductive life that they, I think they have a period once every couple of years or something like that. That's just
that would be awesome.
You know, because of the fact that they just don't have enough fat to make that happen.
I have a couple of questions. Actually, I have two questions. They're kind of one and the same, so I'll just ask them both at once. But I heard a long time ago, and I don't know if it was in a joke or what, but somebody told me that humans, we don't use our pinkies as much anymore. And then eventually down the line, millions of years from now, there's a lot of people who think that people were going to be born without pinkies since we don't really use them. And my other question is there any way that something that's of repetition, something that you do all the time, could eventually evolve out of it? Like, for example, men who have to shave their face every day or every other day, could your body somehow like evolve from that, and millions of years from now men would just stop growing facial hair?
I'll take this one, Dr. Zach. Well, I know that you can't, what you do in your life won't affect your evolution as far as shaving. I know that much, thanks to Dr. Zach.
That must have been in a previous episode.
Well, kind of. He talked about if you work out a lot, your baby won't be grown with, be born with bigger muscles. I mean, the shaving wouldn't matter. It's more that if girls stopped reproducing with men who had a thicker, more amount of facial hair, then eventually down the line that genetic. You take it from here, Dr. Zach. I'm over my head.
So I think what you're getting at is Lamarckism.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I was about to say Lamarckism. Unfortunately, at this point in the podcast, we started experiencing a few technical difficulties. We were recording this episode on what turned out to be the hottest day in LA's history. So my computer overheated and stopped recording. But we fixed it, and we'll rejoin Dr. Zach halfway through his explanation.
In that population, there will be certain members that have a trait that is better suited or worse suited to that environment. And those are more likely to reproduce and pass their traits on to the next generation, which is why it's called natural selection, because the natural conditions of the environment will select one trait over the other arbitrarily based on, you know, whatever that environment happens to be. It doesn't mean that one trait is good or the other trait is bad. It just, that happens to be the environment. This trait happens to benefit, you know, that member of the population, and those traits get passed on. So no, it's not likely that you're going to shave yourself into complete nudity.
Even if you use your pinky.
Right. And you know, about the pinky, I mean, it's conceivable that, you know, eventually we could lose it. Although, I mean, I would look at, you know, all the other primates that are in existence, and, you know, we all share pinkies. So, I mean, the pinky has lasted for millions of years within our family line. And I don't think there's any really good reason to think that it might go away. I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to cut off my pinky.
That's true.
For the hell of it, I mean, I think I might miss it. If I lost it, you know, I it wouldn't be the end of the world, but I don't think I'd want to cut it off either.
Well, now I feel like you're just making fun of me.
No, I don't.
I think more fingers would be useful if you like to type or play guitar.
Yeah, that's true.
How about that, Doctor? More fingers.
Well, that's true. I mean, I would definitely not. I mean, I would definitely hate to lose my thumb. The thumb is absolutely crucial right. to what we do. But yeah.
This question is, do you believe in free will?
Free will. What does it have to do with evolution?
Well, I don't know. That's one of the questions we got sent in.
Okay. So I do believe in free will with a bit of an explanation to that. So there's different types of free will that are talked about in philosophy. So there's sort of libertarian free will, which means that we have the will to do whatever we want, no matter what the situation, no matter our backgrounds, no matter any sort of preceding things that have come into play.
Uh-huh.
On the other side of that is sort of hardcore determinism, which says that we don't really have free will because every decision that we make is controlled by every past decision that we've made, and all the other factors that come into play in our lives. And you know, we are presented with a situation and it looks like, you know, it's a choice, but it's not really, because everything that we've done up to that point leads up to that decision.
Yeah, I think we actually talked about this, and I have a theory about this, actually. I'd love to hear what you think about this, because I know it's not an exact theory, but the analogy that I like to give for that is that everyone kind of knows the you have, like, if you have a DVD player or an old computer, there's a screensaver where whatever the logo is just bounces from corner to corner.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And with a little bit of simple math, you could predict where that screensaver will be at any point for the next million years.
Yes.
Now, if you add turn it to two screensavers, it seems more difficult to predict where it's going to be. I mean, I can predict where it's going to be just looking at it, you know, in 30 seconds just by looking at it when it's just one. But if you add two, then I'm just completely confused. I have no idea where they're going to be. But they're still going to, like, it's just math. They're going to be where they're going to be based on bouncing off of each other, sort of. But you could still use math to predict where they're going to be at any point. Now, if you add like 100 billion screensavers into that screen, it looks like complete chaos. But it's still, they're still all reacting to each other, and they're just bouncing off each other. And the math becomes so much that I don't know that a computer could do it to predict where they would be. But I mean, it's still the exact same math. Do you follow me so far? So if you believe that humans are just made up of, you know, particles that are going to react based on their surroundings, if there was some supercomputer that could take in everything, you know, everything in the past and everything up to this point, it could predict where we would be and what decision we would make using the same math, because it's just, we're just particles reacting to the things around us. Like, it's basically what you were saying about we feel like we're making a decision, but the only reason we're making this decision is because of everything that's come before this.
Right. Right. No. Yeah. So what you've described is basically determinism.
Yeah.
That's exactly what determinism says, is that if you could calculate every single factor and variable in the universe, then you could predict anything that happened at any point in time. Now, there's kind of a middle ground to that, which is called compatibilism. And in compatibilism, you take all of that you just described with determinism, all this You know, everything is controlled by every moment in time is controlled by everything that's happened in every previous moment in time. But you sort of you make that compatible with our perspective on things, because as humans, as we go through life, it certainly feels like, it seems like we're making decisions constantly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I made a decision to, you know, go to the other room and make myself a drink, you know, and then bring it back here.
When you found out you were going to be on our podcast.
Right.
You wanted to get yourself a little bit liquored up beforehand.
Or I make the decision to, you know, go to bed tonight at midnight as opposed to, you know, 12:30. So we're constantly making decisions, and we feel like we're in control of those decisions.
Uh-huh.
It certainly does not seem like anybody else is making those decisions for us. So that's sort of compatibilism, in that nobody else but you, or whatever is going on in your head, is making your decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still worth noting that the all the effects that have acted upon you throughout your entire lifespan, and in fact all the effects that took place even before your lifespan, you know, the decisions that my parents made,
sure,
have led me to this point.
Of course. Well, where do you come down on it?
So I sort of am in a more of philosophically, I'm more of a compatibilist. Scientifically, there is a little bit of evidence that I'm aware of that indicates that we actually do not have a measurable free will. However, we do appear to have a free won't, if that makes any sense at all.
I know it's the opposite of will.
So if you they've done some studies. I believe this was with tennis, where they had people hooked up. They had their brains hooked up with electrodes while they were doing different exercises in tennis.
Uh-huh.
And these are people who were very well experienced at doing this, and they were they were in their element. They were just kind of playing tennis and not really thinking about
sure.
it. They were used to it. Well, as long as they were just sort of playing and doing their regular thing. Their conscious mind was not really engaged, or there was no measurable activity in their conscious mind. However, whenever they made a mistake, right after they made a mistake, there was activity, which seemed to indicate that whenever they had realized that they had done something incorrect, then their brain kicked in to try to stop it from happening.
Oh, okay. I see.
Right. So it's not that they were making active decisions with their conscious brain, but their conscious brain would step in from time to time to try to reverse things that were in motion.
That makes sense.
That's what I mean when I say free will.
I gotcha. Okay.
So there is some evidence to that effect. I'm not aware of anything else that supports scientifically the idea of free will. Now, the reason why people think that this is a really interesting topic and why it drives some people crazy is because the idea of free will is tied in with ethical theory for a lot of people, right? So they think, well, if we don't have free will, then everything that we do is just, you know, we're like a computer program executing, and we can't really be held accountable if we do something wrong. So if I happen to murder somebody tomorrow, it's not that I chose to do it. And if I didn't choose to do it, then I'm not held accountable, and you can't punish me for doing that.
But again, if you follow that sort of strain of logic a little bit farther, you can't fault me for punishing you because I'm not choosing to punish you. I'm only, you know, it was determined already that I was going to punish you. You know what I mean? Like the logic, that argument kind of fails on its own basis, I guess.
Right. And it also presupposes that we want to engage in an ethical enterprise whereby we are punishing people, using retribution as punishment, and I'm not convinced of that either. So
wait, what do you mean by that? You don't believe in sort of
retributive punishment, that when you punish somebody for doing something, that you're doing it to, you know, to get back at them.
Okay,
right?
Yeah.
Right. That's how a lot of people interpret punishment as something that's retributive.
It's like vengeance, but it should be more of to make you understand what's wrong.
Well, and not even to understand. I mean, you don't necessarily have to understand that it's wrong, just to understand that there are certain consequences to your actions, right? If you can at least understand that, I mean, I think it would be great if everyone thought that murder was wrong and not something that you should do. But if at least everybody understood that if you do commit murder, then bad things are going to happen to you, then I think we'd all be in a much better place.
That's true.
But I think that's a little bit more valuable ethically, at least you know, for our society.
Yeah. We kind of got cut off talking about just the sort of basics of evolution earlier. I should say if this comes across choppy, I've been having computer problems because it's been the hottest few days ever in LA and my computer is overheating because in order to get good sound, we have all the windows shut in the studio here. So,
yeah, I think I was talking about dogs before, and are being able to look at dogs and being able to look at all the different breeds of dogs and also knowing that, you know, they came from a common ancestor.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think I got most of that. That part. Yeah. That's a good starting point though, right after that.
Right. So then you take that, and if you can swallow that mentally, right, if you can grapple with that, which most people can, I think, right? So what you have there is you've got one species, and you've got, you know, the species has diverged in different ways, and there's been different, you know, changes that have taken place over the years. So change over time, right? So that's kind of like evolution.
Uh-huh.
But I was saying before with what Darwin was pointing out is that it's an analogy of artificial selection, because we know that with dogs, with the different breeds of dogs that there are today, that those were artificially selected.
Right.
So let's take that. Let's look at another species or another group of species. Let's say hominids, right? Mm-hmm. So hominids and primates, and we've got, you know, humans, we've got gorillas, chimpanzees, orangutans. And let's look at all of those, right? So, just like with dogs, there's a lot of different breeds, a lot of different shapes and things, different characteristics, but there's a lot in common, right?
Yes.
So, sort of similarly, you can look at humans and chimpanzees and gorillas and orangutans and all these other things. And there's some differences, there's some very key differences, but there are some very key similarities. Well, and so the question is now, well, you're looking at several different species, but could it be the case that there is a common ancestor amongst all these groups in the same way that there is a common ancestor amongst dogs, right?
Right.
And so that's basically the argument that Darwin was making, or that was the conclusion that he came to, is that, yes, in fact, there is a common ancestor amongst all species, and that the way that they've diverged is similarly to how dog breeds have diverged using artificial selection. Other species have diverged using natural selection, and as opposed to artificial selection, where you have people going in there picking, you know, different puppies or different whatever for the next generation. You have just the natural environment, you know, happens to, based on whatever characteristics are in the population, you know, one or two or three of that population get passed on to the next generation. And that's the basic difference between natural selection and artificial selection. And that's the natural selection is the mechanism that Darwin proposed for how different species came to be.
Well, when you talk about orangutans and monkeys and apes, that's a that's also seems to be a point of contention with a lot of people who tend to argue against evolution. That's something that I've heard almost used as like a shot against evolution, as though it was like, oh, what, we came from monkeys? You believe we came from monkeys? And the next argument is then why aren't monkeys still turning into
why are there still monkeys?
Yeah, why are there still monkeys? And why aren't monkeys still turning into humans?
Right.
And I've in the past, I don't know exactly what to say, you know, when people say that. And I'd like to hear what you would say in an argument like that.
Well, let's go back to the dog analogy, right? So where did dogs come from? You know, everybody pretty much accepts that that the closest relative to the dog is the wolf. So therefore, what modern dogs came from wolves. So therefore, why are there still wolves? Right.
Right.
I mean, it's the same. It's the same basic analogy.
Sure.
So yeah. So clearly, if you came from your grandfather, why does your grandfather still exist?
Well, he's dead. Thanks for bringing it up, doctor.
Well, really, I mean, a better analogy is you and your cousin, you know, both came from your grandfather. So why, you know, why is it any, why is it a shock that that you and your cousin can coexist if you had the same ancestor?
Well,
that's great. I've never heard anyone make that point.
Yeah,
that's really great.
But I, but I, if I was, if I was arguing the other side, I would, what I would say in that case, let's just take it down where it might go to is, I mean, in on the long, I mean, why do monkeys still exist in the long term? Sure, my grandpa still exists, but when he dies,
there's still going to be grandfathers.
No, you, I think maybe you understand what I mean. Why the someone might say, well, why did monkeys not all, like when, so my cousin and me, my cousin and me now exist when we have kids, hopefully not with each other. Are they going to be like my grandfather or are they going to be like us? And if they're not like my grandfather, then why do people who are similar to my grandfather still exist? I don't know if that makes sense. Did I, you know, like why did monkeys continue to exist if there were, if humans are better and we evolved from them?
Well, there you go. See, that this whole view, this whole question is predicated on the idea that that evolution is a pathway going in a particular direction, and that direction points at humans. That is not the case at all.
Right.
Humans are not better than anything. I mean, we're organisms just like every single other organism on the planet. There's no way to objectively give value to humans versus chimpanzees versus dogs versus, you know, slime mold or anything else like that. We're evolutionarily speaking, we're all different branches on the same tree. Mm-hmm. One is not special, right? And that's really, I mean, getting back to the whole cultural debate, that's what really drives the creationist crazies, because most of them come from a, well, I think they all come from a religious perspective in which they have a fundamental belief that humans are special because they're made in the image of God. Mm-hmm. And evolution calls that into question. Evolution says, well, no, actually, we're not any different than monkeys or gorillas or dogs.
When you say we're not any different, you mean we're not...
We're not special. Right. I mean, we're obviously different, you know, biologically, but we're not special in terms of any sort of cosmic objective value.
Right.
We're not, the universe doesn't, you know, have a picture of us on its night table or anything like that.
That leads me to a question I've always had. And I'm not an evolutionary denier or anything, but
none of us are, by the way. The reason we're asking these questions is
advocate.
Just so we can get you your take on this.
Oh, absolutely.
Out on the air is what I.
But why, if you can even answer this, why are humans so far ahead of any other species? I know we're all different branches, but I mean, we can build things. We're vastly farther ahead, I would think, from my knowledge, than any other species. I mean, some species can throw crap at each other, but we drive around in cars. I mean, that seems like a pretty huge leap.
Well, it all depends on your perspective. Have you ever read Douglas Adams?
I've read the.
He starts off his book, you know, sort of painting humans in a more cosmic perspective and just really pointing out how silly we all are, and on all the things that we think that are so important, you know, like we've got digital watches and aren't we special that we've got digital watches, and you know,
pretty cool.
Yes, I mean, from our perspective, it's, you know, there's no other species that has an iPod, so
right.
Not shit. But I mean, if you want to look at it in terms of sheer biomass, I mean, beetles beat us.
Right. That's ants true. Maybe I'm wrong. Aren't ants the most,
there's more ants. I mean, per pound, there's more ants on this planet than there are humans. We think we're special. We think our shit doesn't stink, but it does, because we're covered with bacteria on the inside and out. Can't get rid of it. Even if we were able to get rid of it, we would get sick and die, you know? So, you know, we have this perception of ourselves as the pinnacle of creation and enjoying the favored spot. And that, you know, it's a holdover from, you know, the old sort of religious philosophy and the way we pictured the world as sort of like Aristotle called it the scala naturae, the natural scale, where there are certain things at the bottom and there are certain things at the top, and the gods were at the top, and then you had the angels, and then you had humans, right? So we were really, really close, but we were certainly better than everything else that existed.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and that's all just arbitrary value measurements. I mean, who's to say that an iPod is the absolute best thing in the universe?
Steve Jobs.
I'll say this. We definitely aren't. I mean, we definitely don't have as many survival skills, or in many ways we don't have the best eyesight, and many things aren't as good as other species. But wouldn't you say that we have things better off? Don't you think we have a better life than any other life form, or would you not say that?
Again,
well, it depends on where you live in the world.
That's true.
If you live in Los Angeles, yeah, probably. If you happen to live in...
Not really.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
I met Fabio once, so I don't want to brag. That's pretty awesome.
Some humans have a very luxurious lifestyle, and other humans, you know, live not at all different than animals. I mean, some humans live with their animals. I mean, they have their animals living like literally with them, so they're sort of one of the pack.
Right. Can I ask you a question? This is completely off topic. This is just a debate that we've had in the past, and I'd like to get a scientist's take on it.
Sure.
If we had a war between ants and humans, humans could use no weapons at all, who do you think would win the war?
No weapons? Gosh.
I mean, we could only use...
Your feet?
Your feet. We're naked.
That would be tough. I mean, are there any seagoing ants?
That's my question. See, that was my point. It's all about water.
I think we could escape to the water and survive there for a little while, but I don't know. I mean,
while we're on the water, the ants are just breeding like mad.
Yeah,
trying to get new armies. They're like the bad guys in Lord of the Rings.
They have a better work ethic, more, for sure.
Yeah, for definitely. More
organized. Ants can work together. Humans can't work together.
That's true.
Good point.
Can from time to time.
I feel like we could trick the ants. That's my point. We can't use weapons, but we could somehow trick them into coming close enough to the ocean at the tide or something like that.
How would we trick them?
We make
a picnic near the ocean.
I'll tell you what we do. A picnic. We get everyone to picnic right by the ocean.
Yeah, exactly.
No, we have ways.
What are they?
Well, ants. I'm sorry. Ants follow the trail of other ants, and we now know the gland in ants that ants use to attract other ants to food. So if we get enough of that particular substance, that's not a weapon. We just lead a trail to something bad.
All right, I give up.
See, there you go. I'm sorry. these are the things we normally talk about, Zach.
The important questions.
Right, the real big ones.
You know what I always thought was interesting? That we live with other animals. We live with dogs. What if there was an animal that we needed food from, and we figured out if we lived in the house, like if we lived with gorillas, could we get a gorilla to just feed us and put a watering dish for us? I mean, that's really the most brilliant move, I think, an animal that figured out how to get another species to take care of it.
It seems like a good sitcom.
I don't know if there are any other species that do that. Are there other than humans that take care of another species?
Non-humans that take care of other species? Well, getting back to ants, I mean, there are ants that farm aphids, for example.
Really?
Yeah, they take care of the aphids, they defend them, and then the aphids produce nectar for the ants.
Wow. I never knew that. That's very interesting.
Ants are amazing.
Thanks, Ben. Do you know any other common arguments that people tend to bring up? I know you've talked about things, arguments that people tend to bring up against evolution.
Well, generally speaking, I mean, there's tons of things that people bring up, and they usually all sort of reduce down to some form of the design argument. You know, which is basically that they'll be saying, well, you know, something really looks like the only way it could have come about is if it had been designed.
Right.
Well, okay. Yeah, I guess you're just not very imaginative then. But once you get past the design argument, sort of the last refuge of the evolution denier is the argument from abiogenesis. Abiogenesis is the process. It's sort of a theoretical process at this point, but whatever process by which non-living material became living originally. So where did, you know, once evolution talks about the first life form and how it's evolved into whatever we have now, right? So, but the big question is, well, where did that first life form come from? You know, how did you get from something? Because, you know, presumably, you know, the Earth was created
in 7 days,
right? You know, congealed out of you know, stellar material, and, you know, was extremely hot and then cooled down, and then, you know, at some point during its history there appeared life. So the question is, well, at some point there was no life and then there was life, so how did that process take place? And that's referred to as abiogenesis. A meaning without, bio is life, and then genesis is the beginning. So the beginning of life out of nothing,
right?
Basically, and there's a number of different experiments that have looked at this. There is no, there are several different hypotheses. There's no singular theory that's been accepted by the scientific community as of yet.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a number of experiments looking at is it possible to generate organic compounds, and when I say organic compounds, I mean those sorts of proteins and nucleic acids and things like that make up life.
Yeah,
and you can actually, there are lots of different conditions, you know, some of which may or may not have been, you know, part of the pre-life Earth, prebiotic Earth.
Uh-huh.
But there are several different conditions in which you can actually form spontaneously these sort of organic compounds. So it's not at all an impossible thing for these compounds to have formed out of nothing.
Right. I've never actually had an argument with anyone who brought that up. It's generally much more limited arguments than abiogenesis. I also was going to ask about the, as far as like the scientific community is concerned, how accepted is evolution?
It's totally accepted.
It's 100. I mean, it's just,
there's no scientific debate, right?
Right.
No, there's no serious scientific. Now there are still ongoing questions within evolution, but nothing. There is no debate within the scientific community that is in any way related to the debate that's going on out in the culture. I mean, it's a totally accepted theory. Then.
Right.
I don't know. I've heard a pretty compelling argument about dinosaur eggs on Noah's Ark.
Well, I want to say also, I have arguments with people about science here and there. And whenever anyone presents anything that like, well, science used to accept this, but now they found out, they don't believe that anymore. Like, science used to think that the atom was the smallest, you know, measurable unit. But the thing is, it's not like science accepted that and then religion jumped in and it's like, hey, nope, the electron. You forgot about the electron. It's always science that corrects itself. That is what science is. And that's what people don't seem to understand. And that's something that always bothers me, is that if science has it wrong, science will be the first. The science is the sort of quest to find out if it is wrong or not. They are the ones that are trying to find out if it's wrong. And when they find out it's wrong, they're excited and they can't wait to tell you that it's wrong. If science discovers God, they will be excited to tell the world about God. It's not, they're not trying to disprove or prove one specific thing. They're looking into things. And that's something that's always bothered me with about people arguing against science as though they're trying to hide or promote something.
And the thing of it is, any new theory that you put on the table that you propose has to take into account all the previous.
Exactly.
Right. So your example about the atom, right? So you had atomic theory, you know, which was a theory that described, you know, basically the workings of atoms as, you know, as the smallest unit of matter. Well, then you had quantum theory, mm-hmm. right? Which describes, you know, different aspects of the inner workings of the atom, mm-hmm. right? But quantum theory doesn't throw out atomic theory,
right?
It's that atomic theory was not able to describe everything in as much detail as quantum theory does.
Yeah.
Right. Just like with Einsteinian versus Newtonian physics, right? Newton, you know, his laws are still valid. It's just that they present an incomplete look at the right. universe. They're still right. They're just not as completely right as Einstein's theory was, and Einstein's theories
have not been expanded
completely
on.
Right either. And there's more explanation that's needed to fill in the gaps that are left by him.
Sure, I think we're probably going to wrap this up pretty soon, so I want to get plugs in real quick. You can listen to Dr. Zach on Evolution 101. All of his episodes are still available in iTunes. Or you want to give out your website as well?
Yeah, well, my website is drzach.net, drzach.net.
And I definitely recommend, if you are interested in any of this, his podcasts do a much better job of sort of describing what he, describing evolution than we gave him the chance to do here. And there, it's also compartmentalized into smaller, more
really palatable. Concise. Yeah, and it's really good for concise. Beginners, I think, too, because we're all beginners.
Yeah. So if you are curious at all, you should check that out. And also, again, Radiolab. I want to get – I feel like once anyone listens to Radiolab, you will then go and seek out more scientific media. And one more thing that we never really talk about this, so I'm just giving all these plugs out now, even though I just want people to look at these things. Anything by Carl Sagan, you can get most of his audiobooks in iTunes. You should definitely do that. Or if you can watch The Cosmos with Carl Sagan, you can watch that on Netflix. It's in the on-demand. You can watch it on your computer as you go to sleep. Everyone should look into all these things. These are all great ways to start learning things.
And you can learn more at your local library.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. This is, I'm sorry if it's been at all awkward. We generally just talk for about 2 hours and then chop it up and put it into and decide what we think is interesting. But this has actually been a sort of sit down show, and we'll probably present it pretty much in full.
Nope.
So it's been great having you on. And do you have any other recommendations other than the things that I gave out for people to seek out who are sort of curious or interested in scientific things?
Well, as long as people are out there looking for Sagan stuff, I'll put in a plug for The Demon Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark. That's really the book that first turned me on to Sagan, and it's all about critical thinking. And I'm not so much, it'd be nice if everyone was atheist, I guess, but I'm more concerned about having as many people be critical thinkers as possible.
I know, again... It's not like I hate religious people, and I always feel like whenever we get together, Ben, Chris, and I, and begin to talk about religion, it just comes across as just us bashing, and that's not what my point is. I feel the same way. I feel like religion is just not about critical thinking, and it, at this point, is doing more to stop critical thinking than it is to promote good things, and that's my only problem with religion. I love the idea of a community and the idea of people getting together and doing good. I absolutely love that. I just think that when it gets in the way of seeking out the truth and it begins to affect policy in our government, that it's not good.
Right. And speaking of religious folks, if you happen to know anybody that is religious and interested in evolution, I always recommend the book Finding Darwin's God by Kenneth Miller. He's a Catholic, but he teaches evolutionary theory, and he is very good at it. It's a very interesting book. It's a really easy way for believers to really engage with evolution, and it explains it fairly simply. And it's really good for anybody, but he does engage in a little bit of the God talk.
Sure.
Because that's his background, and I think I would recommend that for any religious listener or any religious friends that you might have.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Zach. And I'd like to also say, give a shout out to my homegirl, Delaney Shields.
What's up?
Sorry.
That's my daughter.
This is our first podcast with Ben as an official father, so congratulations, Ben.
Mazel tov.
Thank you. Thanks for coming on.
All right, it's been my pleasure. Take care, guys.
All right. Thanks, Doctor.